This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Black people gather in East St. Louis, Illinois, and nearby Ferguson, Missouri, to mark one of the nation's most deadly racist assaults 100 years ago. Mumia Abu-Jamal challenges the prosecutorial racism that put him in prison 35 years ago. And the Green Party puts forward a candidate for mayor of New York City. But first, Reverend Edward Pinckney, the veteran community leader from mostly Black Benton Harbor, Michigan, is breathing free air for the first time in 2.5 years. Reverend Pinckney was released from prison after serving 30 months of a maximum 10-year sentence for trying to recall a mayor allied with the giant Whirlpool Corporation, which has long dominated his city. The newly released political prisoner recalled his ordeal in the Michigan prison system.
I consider this as the 30 stolen months of my life. That's what when I went in there, I had a mindset that I would not allow them to kill me, destroy me, or stop me. That was my plan when I first went in there. I knew that probably the first time in history anybody ever got sentenced and was sent straight to prison. I mean, never before, not in Barron County, let's say it this way. It usually take a week or two before they get the files together and get you into the prison system. But in my case, the judge sentenced me, and I was in the van traveling over 100 miles to get to the prison, all in the same incident. It was no doubt in my mind that they already talked to the sheriff's department, probably the Department of Correction, said we'll be bringing him there. He'll get there at 11 o'clock, and at 11 o'clock I was there. It started at 9 o'clock in the morning. Now remember this, to get to Jackson is at least 2 hours. It started at 9 o'clock in the morning. By 11 o'clock, I was sitting inside Jackson Prison. I really didn't care. I anticipated I would be sent to prison, but I had to prepare myself mentally for it more than anything else because going into a whole different environment of different people, I never thought that I would do the whole 30 months. I thought sure that the Court of Appeal would either give me an appeal bond or dismiss the charges. That was my way of thinking because before, when they had sent me to prison, and when I had quoted the Bible, Deuteronomy, I was given an appeal bond, pretty much the same situation, and it was dismissed. But I was trying to hurry up, get the court actions done, get into the Court of Appeals, and I didn't think for one moment that I would be there 30 months. They would be able to steal 30 months of my life until 2015, April 2015. I knew right then that I was going to have to do all 30 months. I knew that.
What happened on 2015?
We had a hearing in Barron County in reference to the county clerk, and one of the jurors was personal friends. They've been friends for 15 years. That's Sharon Tyler and Gail Freeland. And they've been in parades together. They've been, you know, doing different things. And then when they got to court, they act like they didn't know each other. I never talked to this lady in my whole life. And for 15 years, you've been in parades together. You was an elected official. Y'all be at the bar together. When the judge, there's absolutely no evidence that these two people knew each other at all. So I knew right then because I know how they stick together. Their job was to stick together, come in the courtroom and lie, and keep me in prison. And they accomplished that goal. And I knew it was all over. That was in April of 2015. I knew right then I was going to do all 30. And then the judge echoed the same thing. Whatever the jury say is going to be final in reference to you, Reverend Pinckney. And I had to accept that because there's nothing I can do here in this country with their legal system. You know, you can bring all the lawyers you want in, but they got a system that's designed to defeat you. And that's really what they had. They thought that they had defeated me. Matter of fact, they thought that they had buried me. You know, when someone throws dirt on you And they don't ever expect you to rise again. But they didn't bury me. They only planted me. You see, because when you plant something, you expect it to rise again. They had no idea that I would be back. And I'm back now stronger, better equipped to deal with them than ever before. It just amazed me how the system actually worked, because we as black people, we don't have a clue. If it don't affect you, most likely most people don't even care. They don't care about injustice till injustice knock on their door. And that's how they've been getting away with this stuff for years. So we have to make the major adjustment and deal with it. But amazing grace, dog. You know, I'm feeling good because inside the prison system, I got an education that I would never, ever, ever forget.
Well, share it with us.
Well, here's what's important. When I first went up to Marquette, which was 500 miles away from my home, they weren't prepared really for me. They figured that I was one of them everyday prisoners, that they'll be able to do this and get away with it. They would do it. Everything they did when I was up there, I countered. Rather than them attacking me, I started attacking them. I started putting stuff on my website. I started doing so. They never dealt with me. So then they sent me down to Coldwater, Michigan. And while I was in Coldwater, now this is most of the people who maybe 70% of them is never going, ever going home. But it educated me on how to live inside and survive inside the prison system. They put me in a control area, a cell, with four killers, people who had killed people. And it was me, a guy who's in there for election fraud. And I go to sleep at 8 o'clock. And they sit up and talk until 2 o'clock in the morning. They was talking about who they killed, how they killed. And one morning, I just got sick of hearing them talking about who they had killed. And I asked them the question, the person you killed, did they have a gun? And they all looked at each other and said, no. I said, well, then that makes you a coward. Oh, man, that changed my whole prison stay. They hated me, but other people surrounded me. I mean, they put their arms around me, and they didn't want me walking nowhere by myself. They didn't want me doing this by myself. They kept a close watch on me. And it was teaching me about the prison life, what to do, what not to do, what not to say, and deal with it. And they prepared me now for when I got back to Marquette. They sent me back up to Marquette. Remember, it's 500 miles from my home. So as soon as I got up there, they was ready for me. The first thing they do, accuse me of making a three-way call. You know, that's to cut off the communication from the outside. You see, they immediately said I was on a conference call, but it wasn't a three-way call. And they decided that they normally give you 30 days without your telephone. They gave me 180 days without the telephone. Okay, I can live with that. All right, then I had a guy to come in from Detroit. He flew in from Detroit because he's writing a book and stuff like that. So he had his notes. He got permission to bring it in. On his way out, they stopped him. They told him that they wanted his notes. He said, you can't have my notes. He said, but I'll let you make a copy of them if that's what you want. But, you know, we didn't really say nothing that was interfere with the prison system or nothing like that. But after they got copies of his notes, what they did, they had me arrested and charged me with smuggling. I said, smuggling? How do you smuggle? It's supposed to be smuggling. But they couldn't spell smuggling, so it was smuggling with the O's. So I used to tease them. I call them unskilled, unprofessional, uneducated COs. And they didn't like that because now it was my job to attack them because they're attacking me. I believe in fighting back. So they took me to the hole. And while I'm in there, a group from Northern Michigan and Wayne State was picking in the outside of the prison. This has never happened before in the history of the prison. They never had nobody that far up there in that type of weather to come out and picket the prison itself. So I'm in prison. The lieutenant comes in. Who is this guy Pinckney? They talking about that guy. Who is he? You know, and I'm listening to him because I'm right across from where they talking. And the guy said, well, that's Pinckney down there. He walks down there. I get under the cover so he don't see me, right? Just so he don't get the pleasure. He's asleep. I'll come back later. They picking it all outside. It's all on the news and stuff. The news of it, because they don't get much news. So the news media was there, 3-4 news channels. Pinckney, this Pinckney has been unjustly, he was charged with smuggling. And they broadcast it all over the news that it was smuggling. But here's what's important. I'm in the law library. They announced my name over the loudspeaker. And they said the judge wanted to see me. The judge? There's no judge going to come up here and see me. The judge was the hearing officer. No, I didn't know that. So I go to see the hearing officer. And I tell him that he have to dismiss this. They never dismiss a ticket. Never. I don't care what it is. They don't dismiss it if they can help it. Now, here's the deal. I said, they have absolutely no evidence that I was smuggling. He said, and I said, here's another question. How do you smuggle? And he said, smuggling? He said, you know what they meant, smuggling. I said, yeah, but they wrote on here, this is the official document, that I was smuggling. And he said, I said, well, you have to dismiss this. He said, I don't have to do anything. He said, we don't need evidence to convict you, no way, if we want to. I said, yeah, you got a point there. He said, he rules on how he feels. And I said, you look like you feel pretty good today. He smiled when he gave me that smile. He said, yeah, I do feel pretty good. He said, well, I'll give you my decision at 4:30. And he came back not guilty. So here was their plan. If you cut off my communication completely, then I have no outlet to get anything out other than writing. But what they did was they were trying to cut my telephone communication off. They were trying to cut my visiting power, because people from up there was coming to visit me 2-3 times a week, and they don't like that. These was white folks, actually white folks coming to visit me. And that was one of the things. But what I did that they really didn't like, I started educating the young folks. I started teaching them stuff that they never thought of. See, math is my specialty, and I was showing them how to do math. I don't listen to rap music, but in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, these young guys be listening to rap music. You know, I'm trying to read my Bible, they listen to rap music. So one day, one of the guys came up to me and asked me, did I know how to do this problem? I said, yeah, I know how to do it. And I said, why? He said, well, will you help me? I said, sure, I'll help you. But I'm going to take you all the way back to the root of the problem so you can learn how to do it for yourself so you don't have to ask me. So I took him all the way back to the basics, adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing. I showed him how to multiply. I showed him his timetables and how you can divide and multiply at the same instant. I showed him how, and he was kind of fascinated behind it. And what he did, he brought other people to me. And before it was over, I had 16 young folks teaching them how to do math. I started teaching them how to read, how to think, how to just learn, and how to do work, and how to be productive, and how to be courageous and stand up. I showed them how to do that. And they was excited and never had to worry about watching or listening to rap music on the TV anymore, because they wanted my help. And they actually wanted to learn, which was really, truly amazing. Now, the system didn't like that. They was out to get me. They wanted to kill me. There's one guy, he used to come into the cell and cut the light on and off all night long. I'm sleeping, he'll wake it up. I know he's coming, so I'm prepared mentally to deal with it. And one day I was walking down the hallway. He tried to bump my shoulder. They would have charged me with assault. And he had his hand on his taser. He actually wanted to really kill me, because they've been known to kill people up there in Marquette, and nobody gets in to talk about it. But it was so amazing when you sit down and think about it. It was quite a ride and quite an education for me. It gave me an education that I would never, ever forget being inside the prison system. I'm grateful for it, though. I can't sit here and say that I would do it again. I can't say that. But I will say that it taught me about my people. It taught me now how to fight and how to fight differently and be a little bit stronger, you know. And I know that we have to teach our children. We have to start teaching our young black boys how to read, how to think, how to learn, how to work, how to produce, and how to be courageous. You know, don't get tough because you got a gun in your hand. If that's the only way that you're going to get tough, then you're a coward in my eyesight. And that's how I like to treat them. And I use words like that. Here I am when I was in Coldwater telling these four killers that they were a bunch of cowards And here I am standing a nick over 5'7". And these guys, they were big, Ronnie, never going home. And they say, well, it took a lot of courage to tell these guys. I said, well, it didn't take courage, just the right thing to do. I said, you know, whatever they got for me, bring it on. That's how I look at it. I tell you, Glenn, just the thought of being inside that prison system and never have to go back is a blessing, because every day you get strip searched. You get strip searched, strip searched, strip searched. And the food, this food is the lowest grade of food that you can eat. It's just one step from being slop in a pig pen or something like that. They had what they call potato worms. They had maggots in the food. They had all kind of little bugs in the food. You know, you complain about it, but, you know, they try to get off that, you know, that's just some extra meat they normally say. But, you know, I made it a habit not to eat that food, thanks to my wife. And they would send me enough food, so I cooked my dinner every day and made sure that I didn't have to do that, but other people had to do that. So that was so amazing. You don't think about a person that has no right or should not be in prison. And in my case, more or less, what they did to me was that they knew what they was doing. They knew if they get them all-white jury, I got a 99.9% chance of being convicted, even without any evidence. While I was in the prison, I probably got more than 10,000 letters from people. For my birthday, I'll get 1,000 birthday cards, 1,000 Christmas cards every year. People write me, and they wrote me so much, I couldn't write people back. Very few people I could write back.
Well, Reverend, you're out now, but not out of their control, because you're still on parole.
That is correct. A one-year parole, I'm looking at 11 months and 2 weeks. That's how I'm looking at. I talked to the parole agent on Tuesday, and my thing is that I like to get off in 6 months if possible. I don't see it, but, you know, God can do anything. And here's another thing. When I was going to see the parole agent, they wanted me to see a psychiatrist for a nonviolent crime. And they got guys there who had murdered people, didn't have to see the psych. That didn't weigh in good with me. I think any time you go to prison, you need to see a psych. But you need to see a psych out here so you can tell her, so you can clean yourself up, empty yourself out. Because when you come out, whether you like it or not, you got issues. You got issues within yourself, because it's more mind control than anything else. That's why guys go back. They go back because they're not prepared mentally to deal with reality of being out here. Yes, I'm still under their wings right now. I think I'll be all right. I don't see really no issues. I just do what I do. But it's not going to stop me from doing things, because I'm planning a protest at Barron County Courthouse July the 11th. My goal is to give them a little something, let them know I'm back, let them know that you've tried to bury me, but you only planted me. I'm back stronger than ever, and give Whirlpool Corporation a little something. And here's something, too, that you may not know. Whirlpool Corporation was responsible for that fire in London where 79 people got killed. It was one of the appliances that caused that fire. And their stock went down $500 million. They lost just on that announcement. So I will be picking in Whirlpool Corporation to let them know that you can now be classified as a terrorist, because that's what terrorists do.
Reverend Edward Pinckney, speaking from his home in Benton Harbor, Michigan. A century ago, white mobs killed hundreds of black people in East St. Louis, Illinois, in a slaughter that shaped black politics for much of the remainder of the 20th century. Back in 1917, when the white media spoke of race riots, they meant mass white assaults on black communities. Many historians now refer to attacks like the one on East St. Louis as pogroms, organized racist bloodbaths. Dr. Randy Short was a principal organizer of 3 days of actions marking the massacre. He says these rituals of mass murder were standard white political behavior for many generations.
These things go all the way back to the Jacksonian pogroms across America. I mean, you had a pogrom in Jersey City, a pogrom in Newark, a pogrom in New York, a pogrom in Philly, a pogrom in Cincinnati, a pogrom in Boston. It was a pattern in American life from the Jacksonian era, literally forward 100-year period of when whites were angry or in times of economic stress, the upper class or the elite class of whites offered impunity for whites who took action to destroy black people. It's almost a human sacrifice or an expiation for their failure to provide jobs and opportunity to fellow whites.
The destruction in East St. Louis in 1917 was almost unprecedented in scale. Could you describe what happened?
The East St. Louis pogrom was coordinated by the National Democratic Committee in Washington, the Illinois Democratic Party, the St. Clair County Democratic Party, the AFL, the 33rd Infantry, also known as the Illinois National Guard, AFL President Samuel Gompers, as well as by Veterans of Foreign Wars and the American Foreign Legion, and other whites who had interest in punishing black people for moving to East St. Louis, becoming prosperous, trying to establish independent black unions to negotiate better wages, and for voting as a bloc for Republicans and defeating Southern Illinois Democrats who affiliated with the racist Democratic faction of the party in the South. So the blacks in East St. Louis were forced. They were headed towards becoming a majority in that city. If the population had continued, blacks would have been the majority. That would have been one of the second majority minority cities in America. And they had a leadership that was accountable, that was concerned about the black people that moved there. Unprecedented in our history. And so they were destroyed systematically with support from the White House on down to the state capitol and to the county seat of Belleville, the same city that the shooter of the congressman in Alexandria earlier this month, same city, same Democratic Party.
How did the attack begin and what was the pretext?
The pretext was a lie that there was an immigration scheme where they were going to flood out Alcoa, our fascist aluminum or aluminum manufacturer, the ones who brought us 9/11 in Chile, the ones who brought us coups in Guyana and anti-progressive trade policies against Jamaica. They were called the aluminum ore mining company, Alcoa, and others pitted black workers against white workers. The black workers tried to create multiracial unions, and this wasn't going to be tolerated. So Samuel Gompers and others came to the city to beat down blacks. By the way, there's a monument in New York, Washington, and in Chicago to Samuel Gompers, who was Jewish, but who ultimately riled up white workers, encouraging them to deal with black people. It began on May 28th. A mob of 3,000 white men descended on downtown East St. Louis, attacking streetcars and lynching, beating, and raping all blacks in sight. On that day alone, 270 black businesses and homes were destroyed. The violence continued with no effort made by local authorities to rein in the anger of the white mob, and they began to engage in using what we now call drive-by shootings to terrorize blacks at night. Ultimately, black folks and Odd Fellow and other secret societies began to form paramilitary groups to defend their communities. And one of the results was on the night of July 1st, 1917, black snipers, tired of these people driving through shooting at them, shot into an unmarked car, and they happened to kill a policeman who was a Ku Klux Klansman as he moonlighted. He was moonlighting as a Klansman. And the white community vowed to punish the black community. By the way, I need to mention one of the things that was also going on was there was a lot of interracial fraternization between white men and black women. It made a lot of white women in East St. Louis angry. So on the 28th of May, a young black male was lynched and castrated, and a black female who was alleged to have had a white male friend was scalped. On the 2nd of July, 1917. It was a Sunday. Once it got dark, as the black folks settled in to have their Sunday dinners, as a tradition for blacks in the South, the whites surrounded the black section of East St. Louis, setting fires and with the police who knew the area leading the mobs through, they shot and set fire to everything and everyone. And they set mass fires. So the black folks who tried to leave their homes were shot. Those who could get out were lynched. There are reports of black women getting out of burning homes only to have their babies ripped out of their arms and their babies thrown into the burning buildings. Blacks who tried to flee across the Mississippi were drowned in the Mississippi. As I mentioned, the 33rd Infantry of the Illinois National Guard, who were trained marksmen, shot at will anyone black that they saw. Some blacks were able to escape across the Ede Bridge, a bridge that joins East St. Louis to St. Louis. Some blacks were able to get rafts, and they were able to get out, but many didn't. By the way, the number of blacks that lived in East St. Louis is an undercount number that they like, which is 6,000. A more accurate number was 15,000 plus, maybe as many as 25,000, somewhere between 15,000 to 25,000, because blacks were moving into that area for the war jobs in the thousands every week. There was never really an effort after the fighting and the killing to find out how many people were there. There's never been an agreed figure on the number of blacks killed, and as much as many of them were burned alive, where is there going to be a body? Many of them were drowned, and also there's concern that there was an undercounting of those blacks whose bodies were given to the mortuary persons there. So no one knows how many blacks were killed, but estimates in the hundreds were even cited in white papers. They have no idea how many black people perished.
Now, this event had a profound impact on black politics, which has not been the same since.
Oh, yes. One of the things that needs to be understood, the blacks, once this attack started, church bells were ringing and there were some who had guns who were able to fight. Black folks organized committees to bring weapons and smuggle people, survivors, out of the city to St. Louis to safety. And part of the reason that all the blacks didn't perish is that because they fought back. The poem, If We Should Die, by Claude McKay, many believe this connected to the East St. Louis Holocaust. The NAACP had its largest gathering in 1917 as they marched down Park Avenue. 15 to 25,000 black folks. Their first march only drew 10,000 in 1915. Marcus Garvey's UNIA, which had been floundering, suddenly had a lot of people interested in going to Africa. The NAACP membership soared. Blacks buying guns soared. Even elite blacks like Howard University's PhD mathematician Kelly Miller warned prophetically that if something wasn't done about East St. Louis, they would be shooting in Washington. Was he correct? Yes. 2 years and 3 weeks after the East St. Louis race riot, the same way that whites converged on blacks on streetcars and began killing them, this started in Washington in July 1919, starting off what was called Red Scare Summer.
So East St. Louis inaugurated a new higher level of black political activity. You're in Ferguson, a place that in 2014 also saw the inauguration of another level of black political activity.
Yes, sir. We're here in Ferguson. I'm staying less than a mile from where Michael Brown, God bless him, bled and died, executed. And we are here to commemorate and to celebrate the resilience of our people. And by the way, I need to say this. We should say happy birthday to someone who's no longer with us. This is the 100th birthday of Lena Horne, who, by the way, lost family in East St. Louis. The day after she was born, white mobs were killing Lena Horne's family here in the St. Louis area. And so Lena Horne, who could pass for white, is always known for being aggressively anti-racism, anti-injustice. It's because she grew up knowing from her parents, who were active in the NAACP, about what had happened to her own flesh and blood. The day after she was born, they were killing her own flesh and blood. So that's an icon of resistance to our people, literally was born somewhere else, removed from the flames, but very much impacted by it. And we need to remember Catherine Dunham is from East St. Louis. She's the mother of the Brazilian civil rights movement because she won the Alfonso Arias laws demanding that she not be segregated in Brazil in 1951. Miles Davis is from East St. Louis and the son of a dentist. And by the way, the leader of the black community in East St. Louis was Dr. Bundy, a dentist who was thrown in jail and blamed for the crimes of whites. Josephine Baker, another artist and fighter, was from East St. Louis. So East St. Louis has given much resistance, much pushback.
In your experience, is the younger generation of black folks or even older black folks aware of the events of East St. Louis, including young folks and older folks in Ferguson, not far away?
I don't think people know, but that's changing. I can assure you, just two or three of us working on this, that we already, as of yesterday, had over 1,000 RSVPs for our events. And of course, one of the places that we're meeting can only hold 300-400. Last year, there was a commemoration, not as well publicized, 1,000 people came. This is going to be the beginning of people saying East St. Louis, like they say Black Wall Street. It's only been in the last 10 years that people have discovered Tulsa. By the end of this month, East St. Louis is going to be on the lips of thinking and reading African Americans and also other Americans, because Smithsonian Magazine will be doing a feature story on it, as you will be doing a story, as the Associated Press has advertised this. I have encountered anger and shock from dozens of people who had never heard of this. And once people find out that the number could easily be in the thousands, and people call the pulse the biggest mass death, and they miss places like Elaine, Arkansas, or the mass killing of blacks in Louisiana during the 1868 elections. We're channeling awareness, consciousness, resilience, and a call for a renaissance of a movement for self-determination, for self-respect, for self-defense, for sovereignty, and for collective economic development. They can reach out to me, WRandyShort@gmail.com. I'm Randy Short in Facebook. I'm Dr. Randy Short in Twitter. I'm Randy Short in Twitter. I'm Dr. Randy Short in LinkedIn. If you put in Randy Short and you want information on what's happening, reach out to me. And let on our lips be the words that were being stated by Marcus Garvey and others, never again in East St. Louis. No more East St. Louis's forever. Thank you.
That was Dr. Randy Short speaking from Ferguson, Missouri. The Green Party's candidate for mayor of New York City, Akeem Browder, thinks his fight to get on the ballot will be successful despite the difficulties that small parties face in challenging the rule of the duopoly corporate parties. Akeem is the brother of Khalif Browder, the young man who spent 1,000 days locked up in New York's infamous Rikers Island jail before charges against him were dropped for a crime that he didn't commit. Khalif Browder then fell into a deep depression and committed suicide. His brother Akeem's challenge to Mayor Bill de Blasio is an uphill climb. De Blasio was once seen by many as the great progressive white hope for New York, but fewer people feel that way now that he's up for re-election.
I was never a fan of de Blasio when he first came into office. I didn't like the last-minute move that he did by bringing out his black wife and kids as a leverage to say that he knows what we go through because he has a black wife. He did say that he taught his kids to always be careful around police, which is true. You are a black kid. You don't have a shirt on that says you're the president's kid or you're the mayor's child. However, we can't be confused that this man has nothing to do with day-to-day living as a black man or woman or black and brown skin man or woman living in New York City. He doesn't make what we make per year. He doesn't live in our communities where he knows that the sanitation problem in New York is really bad. He doesn't even involve himself in the fact that they're trying to change Harlem from Harlem's known name to Soha and trying to gentrify our neighborhoods. He doesn't live with these problems. So how could he possibly have been the great liberal progressive? No, he was probably the great liberal progressive to those that voted. And if we know anything about voting, black people and brown people don't get involved in voting because back in the days in my mom's generation, there was that saying that we shouldn't have been doing to our communities, but politics is politics. So we never got involved. So how could the mass, the majority, which we make up the majority in America, we make up 68% of the population. And so he couldn't have been entitled that by the majority because the majority didn't vote for him.
In terms of the criminal justice system, you've made that a large part of your campaign, and you know something about it.
Well, yes. Around the city, there's this approach to say that I'm the mayor running on a justice platform. And I'm settling into that thought because I want people to understand that the Department of Justice doesn't have only just a hand in our black and brown skinned brothers and sisters going to jail. That's just one of the problems. So we have to start looking at things as a whole. And the Department of Justice does have a hand in our kids growing up with the school to prison pipeline system. Better yet, let's take it before that. They have a hand in our adoption system, which I too was a part of the adoption system. I was adopted as a kid. So it starts right there where surveillance is already given. And then the school to prison pipeline system, the unemployment system, our immigration system, the fact that we have food deserts in New York where equality isn't really equality if you come from our neighborhoods. So yeah, it might sound like a justice mayor, but I'm actually the equality mayor. I want equality for all of us, not just those that can afford. But I believe also that there's a way that we can change that. And that's what I present to the public, that, you know what, I don't know why we've been overlooking this, but maybe it's just because we didn't have the right person in office.
Yes, but much of your work prior to entering this campaign has involved the criminal justice system, a system that claimed the life of your brother. And you've been pushing a law named after your brother called Kalief's Law that would speed up the trial process in New York. And you've also been advocating that the age of criminal responsibility be raised to 21 years old instead of the current 16.
Yes. We do have a problem in New York. It's more recognized now because of the injustices that happen, not just in jail, but on our streets where it's over policing. We have a police state right now, and that's because we took away community policing. And so when you don't have community policing and we have to rely on the courts and the systems in place to raise our kids, well, we've been now noticing, I don't know why we haven't noticed before, but it takes now the death of Trayvon Martin and Eric Gardner and Sandra Bland and Kalief Browder, my brother, for us to start saying at that point when Kalief was taken from us, from my family and the public, when he's taken from us, then they said, wait, enough is enough. Even if I didn't vote before, I'm voting now. Even if I didn't stand up to what happened with Eric Gardner or Trayvon Martin, I'm standing up now because what we're doing to our kids is now being brought to the face of the public. So we raise the age, and I'm trying to make a difference in this because with Kalief's Law, the United States, we have, if you're a citizen in the United States, you have the right to enjoy the privileges of the Constitution. And the Constitution says we are supposed to have a speedy trial. Now, every state is supposed to have the constitutional right. And Texas is the only state that actually has the absolute constitutional speedy trial. Every other state has a version of speedy trial, but at least they have speedy trial. New York is the only state to have no speedy trial. What they have instead is what's called the ready rule. When we're ready for you, we'll get to you. So a 16-year-old that's sitting on Rikers for an alleged backpack shouldn't have to have waited for his day in court or his day at trial to face his accuser, but it took 3 years for Khalif, and he still didn't have to face an accuser because the state dropped the charges and said, we got the wrong person and let him go. And then left the family to pick up the pieces. You broke my brother, and then you send him broken without any help, without any psychotherapy, without any compensation to say, we know that we just took 3 years of your life. Money doesn't equate to anything, but at least for now, here's this. You were a child. We took your childhood away. And so let's see how we can fix this. Nothing was done like that. Actually, what they did was assumed responsibility wasn't with the Department of Corrections. It's just the process. And so they never accepted responsibility. They keep on denying that my brother was taught suicide from jail.
That was Akeem Browder, the Green Party candidate for mayor of New York City. The 4th of July is just another day behind bars if, like Mumia Abu-Jamal and many others, you are a political prisoner in the United States. Mumia's 35 years in prison, much of it on death row in the 1981 killing of a Philadelphia police officer, has been marked by many courtroom dramas, punctuated by massive mobilizations of his worldwide supporters. There was encouraging news on the legal front last month. Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with Dr. Johanna Fernandez, a professor of history and African American studies at Baruch College and a key organizer in the campaign to bring Mumia home. Dr. Fernandez explained the complex legal issue that is now before the Pennsylvania courts.
Judge Leon Tucker of the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia has ordered the DA's office in Philadelphia to resubmit complete verified discovery of former DA Ron Castile's personal involvement in Mumia's case. Now, let me remind your audience that on April 24th, the day of Mumia's birthday, his attorneys were before the court, and the presiding judge was the same judge, Leon Tucker. The issue that was addressed was whether or not former DA Ron Castile violated Mumia's constitutional rights because he had been involved in some aspect of the case when he was in the DA's office, and later when Ron Castile, former DA, became a judge, he refused to remove himself from Mumia's case, and as a result, violated his rights, because it's assumed that if a judge was previously involved as a prosecutor, he's not going to review the case before him justly. So that was the issue that was being discussed on April 24th, the issue of judicial bias in Mumia's case. And so out of that court proceeding, Judge Leon Tucker requested what is known as discovery. He demanded or ordered that the DA's office release all of the files that might point to Ron Castile's involvement in Mumia's case. And the judge requested that those files be released by May 30th, 2017.
So essentially, Judge Tucker is stating that the DA's office did not fully comply with his order. And so now the district attorney's office must again divulge whatever files that they have. And now they have to account for how they went about locating those files. Is that right?
Correct. So on May 30th, the DA's office essentially released publicly available files, literally files that any one of us could have Googled. And this new order that has just come down is requesting, quote, that the DA's office resubmit complete verified discovery of DA Ronald Castile's personal involvement in Mumia's case. Essentially, the judge is telling the DA's office that he wants receipts, and I'm now talking in the parlance of 21st century urban culture. So show me the receipts is what he's saying.
And speaking of receipts, ironically, the DA's office in Philadelphia has been having a lot of legal trouble of late, most recently with the guilty plea and subsequent jailing of former Philly DA Seth Williams. Do you think that that might have any bearing on the development of Mumia's case?
Well, that's a good question. The conclusion of the situation is still unfolding, but essentially, as you said, Seth Williams, who's the first African-American DA in Philadelphia, was tried for bribery and corruption, essentially taking bribes from all kinds of people in Philadelphia. I think personally that what's going on in Seth Williams' case is that they're setting an example, or they're using him as a straw man, if you will. They're using his case, which is about petty crime, to suggest that the institutional apparatus in Philadelphia is addressing corruption. What is missing from any reporting on the situation is that the corruption in Philadelphia has a long history and involves not petty bribery, but wrongful convictions, collaborations between the DA's office and the Fraternal Order of Police and the local police departments to gain convictions. And that's the real history of corruption that we need to pay close attention to, because that kind of corruption has destroyed the lives of countless African-American and Latino men and women in Philadelphia, many of whom are wrongfully imprisoned in Pennsylvania right now. So I think that this is a distraction from the real problems in the criminal justice system in Philadelphia, which, as your audience might know, is the district that incarcerates the largest number of African-American and Latino people in the United States. So that's the question that we have to turn our attention to, but it's no surprise that they're making an example out of the first black DA because of his race. And I would venture to say, and I'm no supporter of Seth Williams, that if Seth Williams had been white, he would not be in prison today. The judge yesterday essentially took him into custody, saying in court that he didn't trust that Seth Williams would stay in Philadelphia and not flee the country. Of course, Seth Williams did plea guilty to bribery and corruption, and there were quite a number of other counts. I think there were a total of 28 counts, and those were dismissed. So he's now facing approximately 5 years in prison, and we will not know the outcome of this until October, when he'll be sentenced. But he is now in jail, and he will be in jail at least until October.
Speaking of racialized issues with respect to the Philadelphia DA's office, was it not Ronald Castile, the same judge who's being implicated in violating Mumia's rights, was he not involved in the DA's instructional tape, which explains how to keep black people and others off of juries in surreptitious ways?
Yes, that's actually an excellent point. So under DA Ronald Castile's tenure, a tape was produced in the Philly DA's office, and that tape is known as the McMahon tape. It was a training tape recorded by one of the DA's in Philadelphia at the time, Jack McMahon. And the tape itself, its introduction, has on it the words DATV. So the fact that this was produced by something, an entity called DATV, suggests that Ronald Castile had something to do with the production of this tape, and the tape, as you suggested, essentially instructs prosecutors on how to exclude black people from the jury. So it is this kind of corruption that we need to call attention to, that for many, many, many years in the Philly DA's office, that office was pursuing conviction over justice by hook or crook, in collaboration often with the police. So, yeah, the Philly DA's office is in the spotlight right now, and the case of Mumia, because it is world-renowned, has a potential to really intensify the crisis of legitimacy that's going on in Philadelphia and call attention to the real issues.
Right. And you said that Judge Tucker ordered this more complete release of the files with documentation as to how those files were located is due on July 7th. What efforts are being made outside of the courts to raise awareness around this issue of stonewalling the judge around the release of these files?
We're asking people to call, email, or tweet the Philly DA's office and ask them to release all of the files in Umia's case and to follow the order of the judge this time. We're also asking people to join us in front of the DA's office on July 7th at noon. So there's a rally and press conference on July 7th in front of the DA's office in Philadelphia to demand the release of these files. I think it's important to go back to really clarify to your audience exactly what it was that the judge ordered once again, and its language. Again, his language asked the DA's office to, quote, resubmit complete verified discovery of former DA Ronald Castile's personal involvement in the case. Now, the judge, Leon Tucker, identified the documents, and he said in his ruling that the documents should include but not be limited to, quote, memoranda of the case during pretrial, trial, and direct appeal proceedings, as well as notes or memoranda of meetings that were held between the former DA, Ronald Castile, and his staff. And he's also requested press releases, public statements that might have been made by Ronald Castile about the case. What's important about this ruling is that it implies that the DA has to formally swear that it engaged in a thorough search for these documents. Now, part of the problem here is that, unfortunately, our courts are asking the same office that's involved in corruption and has been involved in corruption historically to essentially do the right thing and follow through on this promise of democracy and the rule of law. This is not unlike, you know, asking the police to police themselves. So there is a problem with this very notion that the DA's office is going to do what they're asked to do and that they're not going to continue to stonewall. If we lived in a different society, there would be an independent body that would move in and search all of the files. this wouldn't be left to the DA's office, because clearly, as the long history of corruption in Philadelphia suggests, the DA's office can't be trusted.
You keep regular communication with Mumia. I'm wondering if he has spoken to you at all about this most recent reorder by Judge Tucker.
It's interesting. I did speak to him last night, and he said, well, the verdict's not out yet. We'll see what happens. And although he is, I think, surprised, positively surprised about this order, he understands the limitations of the law and the limitations of the process that puts the pursuit of justice in the hands of those who are systematically engaged in breaking the law and advancing injustice in our society, and in particular in his case.
The campaign to bring Mumia home asks supporters to call the Philly DA's office at 215-686-8000 or email them at da_central@phila.gov.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.